over words. And I have learned to claim no easy victories. In fact, I don't expect you to believe anything I've said. You can dismiss my words. You can turn your back. You can forget I ever spoke to you. You can deny everything I've said and scream out loud that it is not the truth. But it is the truth. It is real. And no amount of denial on your part will make it unreal. We live in a world where colonialism, capitalism, imperialism, racism, patriarchy, and all the other maddeningly persistent monsters that weigh like a nightmare on the brains of the living have an enemy. An enemy that sees a future without them and tirelessly works to make it so. Communists reveal through their deeds what humanity is capable of. A world without chains. And so it is all that the monsters can do to make us out to be the biggest monsters of all. Because to them, we are. I chose this. I chose to be a monster in the eyes of the powers that be. But whether I am a monster to you or not depends on your willingness to open yours.
Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello, how are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity?
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people of scarcity and hardship. And that's done by those at the top who work us
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, and the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty, when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. Anyway, that's one of the points one has to make. Well, mm-hmm. what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term like all the time these days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit, we came out of a deep depression that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the depression. But that war got people out of the depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down. There was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going in 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education, these things. That they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, keep up with the Reds. And here, here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation. And all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things. And it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West. And that's when the mythology also emerged that America is the land of prosperity. And for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America everybody's got a car now and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money to subsidize the automotive industry, and these superhighways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah. So of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right. Austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 19, as they say, the 80s or so is a turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, mm-hmm. you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You know, you have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back, Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. You know how things are, and it came out overwhelmingly. People saying it was better under communism,
mm-hmm.
better under communism. You know, the farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and. And students, it was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, and more accessible. And you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how. War is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So, how does that really imperialism tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism. The empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the
mm-hmm.
people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes? Right there, that's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism. But it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal, and to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And
yes.
If it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like, imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's mm-hmm. why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they, too, underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos, and even in the area of food, where the food is, I mean, the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know. Mm-hmm. And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, and all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity, stop looking for a handout from the government, stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare. And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself, I'm telling no, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right, like who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies, agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry piping up their racket. It's gotten more. It's given people more services, but it has been but these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, you know, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits. I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, you know, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say this. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper. The service is better. You don't have CEOs who are making $2, $3, $4 million a year as a CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else. We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying, there's a gas leak somewhere here. And the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself. And it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt. And about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there, they were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Public transportation here carts more people than the congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants restaurants we can say, it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop and they really have the little touch to it than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go social function by social function and say, well, what's been better, What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And, this is something that definitely should be in the public domain. Needless to say,
if there's an accident with a public system, never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company.
Yeah.
That's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, and so forth.
Yeah.
But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this
right.
is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, oh, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cleanup goes to social also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
of the
a private one, you said, did yeah, you say, Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. There was a big scandal back in like 1995. Like
did
this
they,
happened, right?
Did they
right?
put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big, big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that were had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being being ready to blow up or something. Mm-hmm. They did all that, but it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers. And I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native indigenous peoples in North America, who 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost three centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just destruction, to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, mm-hmm. indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and
mm-hmm.
holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, mm-hmm. I think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too in some instances, you know. It's just got a lot. There's just an awful that you know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway, And of course, and then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. Look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place, but that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, you know, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, been quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places, and even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
And as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true, you know. Another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation, and they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington D.C. A few months ago, right? And, like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House, and these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these, I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there, and you also had, like, the Indigenous dynamic in there as well, and it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up. You know, gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages. But I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed.
This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies, which I think you... Who publishes that?
It was... it's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
All right. And once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your books, you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote, you know, just if all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart.
you know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. All right, so Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Right, sure. Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My name is Maheen, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
This September 24th, you're invited to take the Hoofbeat Challenge. Hike, walk your dog, or ride a horse on the Sunrise Trivia Trail, located at the Sunrise Therapeutic Riding and Learning Center at 6920 Concession 1 in Puslinch Township, near Guelph. There's a $50 entry fee, though this will be waived for attendees who bring $50 or more in pledges. You can enjoy the beautiful trails, have lunch from the Country Kitchen food truck, complete a fun quiz to win prizes, and register by September 1st to be eligible to win a $100 restaurant gift card. Sunrise provides a nationally accredited program for adults and children with special needs. The location is wheelchair accessible, and the trail may be accessed with all-terrain mobility devices. As a parent of two Sunrise campers, we'd really appreciate your support.
Hi, I'm Nicholas, and I ride at Sunrise. Please come to Hoofbeat Challenge and support riders like me.
For more information, go to www.sunrise-therapeutic.ca or call 519-837-0558.
Êtes-vous francophone ou francophile?
CFRU is looking for French-speaking volunteers to start or contribute to French language programming on the station. Le genre du programme est à vous, que ce soit sur les actualités, la justice sociale ou les arts, la meilleure émission sera sur un sujet dont vous êtes passionné. Nous offrons la formation gratuite en technologie et production des médias.
Envoyez un message avec votre nom et coordonnées à Brian par courriel à polylingual@commercialcfru.ca pour devenir bénévole dans cette nouvelle radio collective. Apportez votre voix à CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio communautaire de Guelph.
Familiar sound of summer. It's also a warning for kids to stay away. Every year, the War Amps enrolls children who are amputees due to lawnmower accidents, like Roan. He fell off a riding lawnmower and the blade severed his leg.
Hey, I'm Roan. I'm a safety ambassador and I have a message for all kids. Don't let it happen to you. Spot the danger before you play. Play safe!
Learn more at waramps.ca.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, How I Became an Activist. How does someone change or learn or find the courage to speak out? Michael Parenti grew up in a poor working-class Italian community in New York City. When he received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962, he was the success and pride of his family. He risked and ended his academic career when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam. Ultimately, the choice he made then was a good one. He now is an independent political writer and thinker and author of over 20 books. Invitations to speak come from all over North America. His topics are history, fascism, U.S. imperialism, globalization, and terrorism. His writings have been translated into more than a dozen languages. Here is Michael Parenti on How I Became an Activist.
When people speak about how they became what they are, they usually refer to a melange of influences and issues. You know, then there was this teacher who did this. I mean, I'll do the same, but I'd like us to keep something in mind, and that is we're not just a mixture of these influences. You bring your own mental labor power, your own emotive concern. You bring your own innate energy and insight to an issue and a cause. And this adds to our collective impact and our collective empowerment. People sometimes say to me, they don't ask, they say, you're red diaper, right? You're red diaper. You know, I guess assuming you hold so fast to these views, you must have got them through your mother's milk, you know. And I say, well, no, I'm not. My consciousness and my activism was arrived at through a very circuitous process, mostly self-education, mostly undoing my miseducation. And, you know, quite often, the most important dialogue we have is with ourselves. So remember that. It's an interior dialogue, at least on a lot of occasions. At least it is for me. We do have evidence of people who have never had an interior dialogue. But they're all in power right now. I always thought that red diaper babies are very lucky. I'll give you two examples of red diaper babies that I know. One of them is my son, Christian. The other red diaper baby I know, I think he's red diaper, is Ralph Nader. He says, my father, Ralph Nader is talking, he says, my father, and I'm saying, hey, Ralph had a father. I just didn't think of him in those terms, but of course he had a father. He said, my father once said to me, Ralph, he said, capitalism doesn't fail because it always has socialism to bail it out. It's a very good insight. Namely, that means that, and you see it happening today, that the corporations have the bailouts of the collective wealth. They get, in fact, bailouts. They're called bailouts when they're into a bankruptcy. They get tax write-offs. They get direct subsidies. They get research and development subsidies. They get export subsidies. They get loan guarantees. I mean, you can go on. I don't even have the list. So they feed off the collectivity that they're constantly denouncing and saying collectivism, individual initiative. They've got their hands in the public trough right up to their elbows and their necks. Now, in my home was relatively politically impoverished. It was a blue-collar, Italian-American, working-class, low-income. We were really poor. Money was a constant problem and a concern, which itself is a political lesson that one kind of learns in one's gut, really. Not in this society, not that much in your head. I mean, there were some good knockdown, drag-out fights about Mussolini and the war. I remember those between my uncles and various people. And then there was the depression and the poverty and the fear of that depression. But generally, it was a rather provincial existence. I mean, there was a candy store and the handball court and the backyards and the street. I was a street kid. I lived in the streets. I learned to fight. There were a lot of fist fights. We used to beat the brains out of each other. So when people ask me, well, how did you get from this neighborhood and how did you get all the way up to Yale? I always say, I didn't get all the way up to Yale. I don't think it was an ascent. I got across to Yale, as I put it. I said, but I can sum it up in one word, and that's dogs. That is, my grandfather had a brown dog, and he named him Brownie. My Uncle Nick got a white dog, big fluffy white dog. He named him Whitey. And we got a dog that had spots on it, and everybody called him Spotty. And that was the level of imagination in my family. and that's when I knew I had to get the hell out and go to school. The other explanation is, I didn't do it all on my own. How did you do this all on your own? I didn't. The other explanation is that it wasn't self-made. I mean, this society is full of mythologies about self-made man. He's a self-made man. Nobody's self-made. I could never have gotten close to getting any kind of education if there hadn't been, for generations, untold numbers of people, like a lot of the people in this room, whose names I don't even know, who fought for the principle of public education. You know, I was just three generations back from not only a grade school education, but a public education at the college level. That was the only way I went to college. In fact, I couldn't even go to college at first. I'll get to that in a minute. But what we're saying here, and then even pressuring for the stipends and the fellowships at Yale, I couldn't have gone to Yale if I hadn't gotten support from them. So there's two things we got to keep in mind here. First, in anybody's socialization process, there's a self-generated component to all accomplishment. There is a certain thing that the person is doing, synthesizing everything I said before and putting some creative input into it. And there are other times when we so focus on the individual accomplishment that we overlook this collective effort and the social context that it takes place. All individual human endeavor is also a collective social endeavor. When I was in high school, I began to get vaguely interested in politics, and I thought of myself as a Republican. I thought that would get a real laugh, but I guess it didn't. And that's because the only thing I read was the New York Daily News, which was a Republican right-wing rag, and the New York Journal American, which was a Republican rag. I was very afraid that communism was going to be taking over the whole world. The very first presidential, politics in our house, I guess, was electoral, as it is in most houses. People start giving it attention when an election's coming around. And the first presidential election I remember, where I really was reading and following it a bit, was the 1948 election between Harry Truman and Tom Dewey. I remember one day my father just saying, it was just I and my mother sitting there. He said, "Truman's finished. Truman, he's gotten kicked one side down the other. He's falling apart. He'll never get reelected. He's a loser. We might as well vote for Dewey, who's been governor of the state. If we got to make a change, Dewey isn't so bad." And my mother sort of nodding and all that. And then on election day, she came back from the polls and she took me aside and she said, "Michael," she said, "don't tell your daddy, but I voted for Truman." And I know what it was. You know, everybody predicted that Truman was going to lose. And hers was a compassion vote. My mother was very compassionate. She was afraid that maybe nobody in America would vote for Truman. And so she wanted to make sure that Truman got a vote, at least some votes. And so a little while later, I saw my father. I said, "Dad, who'd you vote for?" And he said, "Hey." I said, I didn't know he was on the ballot. Oh, who? "Pop, who'd you vote for?" He said, "The goddamn Republicans, you know, if they get in, it will have another depression. I voted for Truman. But don't tell your mother." So, I mean, you give a teenager this kind of weaponry. The very first chance I could, at dinner, when they were both sitting there, I told the both of them what they were done. And they sort of embarrassed grins and all that sort of thing. So that was my first memory of an election. The point I wanted to make there was, when Truman got reelected, I found myself, despite all my Republican reading, I found myself feeling very happy about that it wasn't Dewey. So that my inchoate class experience was stronger in me than the crap that I was filling my head with from the major media. Which luckily it's not that way anymore, because the media is now free and independent and objective. I didn't go to college after high school. I graduated a couple of years after that election, and my mother was dying. We had terrible medical expenses. We'd never heard of health insurance, and a lot of people today still haven't heard of health insurance. So I went to work. I don't want to go into all those interesting things about work and where and all that, but we don't have time. In college, I met students who were, in their own ways, just as provincial as I, but some of them had exposure to music and literature and politics, and I really began to enjoy that. I would go down to the gym on 23rd Street and box because, as I say, you know, East Harlem, if you're going to walk the streets with your head up, you had to know how to fight. And here I was in college, and I would go down, and I never tried for the team, just sparring, you know. And then after that, I would meet my girlfriend, and we would go to the Irving Berlin modern dance thing, and I would do modern dance with her and other people. And I said, boy, these are two worlds. I'm not sure I fit in either of them. I don't quite know what's going on. But it was kind of interesting to see all these kind of new and different things, and to hear some of these kids talk about things, political experiences. So by then, I actively supported Adlai Stevenson in 1952. I was a liberal. I worked for the Liberal Party in New York, but I was still an anti-communist. The religion of that was still there. One of the real crucibles in my life was the civil rights movement. It was really one of the great political struggles that moved me, as it did so many other people. I would take nonviolent workshops with CORE, Congress on Racial Equality. And those were interesting experiences for me, to actually sit there at a table and someone whacks you across the face or smacks you or hits you with a rolled up newspaper. And I mean, a whole different way of reacting, because you get up swinging in East Harlem and you had to not do that and just sit and go like this. And so I can't wait till it's my turn, you know. And because we would, you know, change places and roles, and I would check out the whoever hit me the hardest got it back, you know. So you can take the kid out of Harlem, but you can't, whatever, et cetera. Now, what motivated me, I didn't know any African Americans, or I knew a few African, I mean, some acquaintances. I had one African American buddy in high school, and we lost track of each other, though. It wasn't that I had some personal connection. It was a question of justice. It was the injustice of this racism and this separatism and this stuff, the injustice of it. I just know then and I know now that the thing I love most, more than beauty or love or happiness, is justice, to see justice in the world. And that was the feeling I had. I became and I remained a liberal academic right up until the Vietnam era. I was active. I mean, by this time I was an activist. I had gone out on the Woolworths boycotts because they weren't hiring African-American workers and trying to get people turned away. There was a number of things we did. Well, along with the civil rights movement and the anti-McCarthyism, I was right there at the height of McCarthyism, and we did fight all that stuff. Later on was the Vietnam War, and that became the other impact on me. I began to question the war. And then I began to question the leaders who produced this war. And then I began to question the system that produced these leaders. And that's when you cross the line and you say, what is this about? I demonstrated, I picketed, I blocked a draft board. Remember a draft board center in New Haven, Connecticut, and the police grabbed me and pulled me through this hallway. One cop holding me here, one cop here. The one holding me here had his club and said, I'm going to kill you, you dirty communist bastard. I'm going to kill you. And the third cop was coming and hitting me in the stomach, you know, with his club. And I suddenly appreciated all that training at the boys' club and at the city college downtown. We used to have a medicine ball for boxing, you know, and you slam it into your stomach, toughen up. And so I would do that every time he hit me. And so it wasn't too bad. But threw us in the paddy wagon, and I said, wow, it's good to really firsthand experience democracy in action, you know? Yeah. During the Kent State days, we had huge demonstrations. You know, people always think, I see all those documentaries on Berkeley or Madison, Wisconsin, or sometimes Columbia. There were schools all over the country where these things were happening. Even some of the same kinds of personalities of the student leaders or faculty leaders, protesters, whatever else. And the same kind of events, the police and this and that. And you couldn't predict it. You know, it was a really remarkable, exciting time. All sorts of people. In Urbana, the fraternity guys were having special teach-ins against the war. The jocks, some of them were. It's a very interesting thing. You can't really predict. There's something about the people where they synthesize and electrify and mobilize each other and begin to do all sorts of things that weren't expected. It was in Champaign-Urbana where my academic career pretty much ended because I got beaten up by the a police in a, we were blocking a driveway, and I mean badly beaten. I was hit, bloodied, my whole head covered. The state troopers had clubs like this that were about that thick, and they were coming down. And one of them, they were up on the side, and one of them came right down to hit me right here on the top of the head, which would have killed me. But someone else, another trooper, hit me on the side here. That tilted my head, so his blow hit the corner of my head. And I heard this guy in the jail say, if I had gotten a good first clean lick on that guy, he'd be a dead man now. And then I heard a couple of other people standing there in civvy clothing saying, that's Parenti. Now the chancellor will want us to throw the book at him. Let's hit him with everything. Plus, when you're that badly beaten, they have to justify the beating by trumped up charges, mob action, felonious assault, blah, blah, blah. And the chancellor who wanted the book thrown at me was Jack Pelterson. When I moved out here to Berkeley, the chancellor at Cal here was Jack Pelterson. I said, am I having a recurrent nightmare? What is this about? No. So I was found guilty. They brought in state troopers who said that I had punched out this state trooper who was 6'2". So I was sentenced to 2 years in prison. What saved me was I got probation. I was already out of the state and teaching at the University of Vermont. There was a big flap there, and I'm not going to go into all the war stories, but there was a constant struggle and a constant fight. And what the system does is they attack ad hominemly. They attack the protesters. So they make the protester the issue rather than the things we're protesting. So to make that whole long story short, I've been kicked out of some of the best universities in America. I remember that I was considered a wild man by some of my academic colleagues. Parenti, he's a wild man. Stop that anarchist agitation. But it wasn't that I was so wild. It was that they were so tame, I think. I realized only in retrospect that I was becoming a Marxist without having read Marx. I would say things like, I think a lot of liberals are evading the whole issue of class power. There's class power, and that class power plays a role in foreign policy. This is really an imperialistic kind of thing we're looking at. And people would say, that's Marx. Whoa, that's Marx. Or I'd say, I don't think the police are neutral. We always hear they're neutral, they support the law here and there. I don't think they're neutral at all. You look at strikes, the police are always defending the factory against the factory worker. Why don't they favor the factory worker against the factory owners? That's Marx. That's Marx, isn't it? And I say, I don't think racism is just an attitude that people learn. It's that too. But I think it's a social force that's used and instigated and mobilized to divide people, to divide the working class. That's Marx, isn't it? That's Marx, And so I started saying, this guy Marx must really be something. Whoa. Here I am knocking myself out to get an analysis, and they're giving him the credit all the time. And he's been dead for how long now? Well, as I say, I was considered a radical. I still am. But I don't think I'm so radical. It's that they're so conservative, all those other people, right? What we do know is that there are left, progressive, supposedly literate intellectuals who do not see how much the dominant paradigm has seeped into their political consciousness like so much dry rot. And by the way, it's a constant struggle for all of us. All of us. We live in a political culture that is quite insidious, quite resourceful. It has propaganda, but it's not called propaganda. It has images that are paraded constantly. It has duplicity. And so we have to consciously arm ourselves against it. So I was called a wild man. I was called extremist. Is it extremist? Let me ask you the question, to want peace and social justice. You see, I have to guard against it. Some of you have to learn the English language again. The extremists are already in power. These guys are not conservatives. They are reactionaries. They are reactionaries. They are consciously... We learned that a conservative was someone who resisted change and wanted to keep his privileges and interests intact. A reactionary is someone who wanted to unturn all these things and go back to a yet more retrograde.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure. Pizza Trocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Trocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7.